All right, let's start over. It's just scene one, take two.
This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I am your host, Jeff.
And I am your other host, Kim. And this is your official warning. We talk about movies here. That means there will be spoilers.
Since we are reviewing a Star Trek film, we wanted to bring in a couple of Trekkie experts. One of them is my brother, Marcus.
Hey, how's it going?
And the other is our brother from another mother, Morgan.
Hey, glad to be here.
It's a tradition for us to talk about something else we've watched this week, aside from the movie we're reviewing. So keeping it spoiler-free, share with us a film or a TV show or something that you've watched recently.
Yeah, so I've actually been rewatching the Boston Legal series from the early 2000s, which, ironically enough, one of the main characters is William Shatner, Captain Kirk, obviously, along with a plethora of other Star Trek guest stars, Rene Aubergeois from Deep Space Nine, who portrayed Odo, and several other guest stars throughout the series who were on different Star Trek series, which is pretty funny.
What about you, Marcus?
Currently, I'm watching Stargate SG-1. It's probably the fourth or fifth time going through it all again, all the seasons, and I believe there's 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a great show. Actually, the star, one of the most stars, is Richard Dean Anderson, who was the star in MacGyver.
So I saw the movie Stargate with Kurt Russell and James Spader. That was good.
Yeah, the movie's great, but it's just a totally different beast. Basically, Richard Dean Anderson is not Kurt Russell, mm-hmm. but he was great in Stargate SG-1, you know. But Kurt Russell does great in the movie, though.
So, Marcus, why don't we start with you? Tell me about your love of Star Trek. Where did it begin?
Actually, speaking of Stargate SG-1, after I got finished with all those episodes, I was craving another show, you know, obviously in the sci-fi genre, and that's mm-hmm. where Star Trek came in. And, you know, Morgan's a big fan of Star Trek, and I thought, you know, what the heck, I'll give it a try. So I started with the Next Generation and ended up really liking it. Next, I think I started Deep Space Nine, which absolutely fell in love with Deep Space Nine. And that's just how it all began.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I've been watching Star Trek since I was a kid, you know, definitely over 25 years at this point. My parents both watched it when I was growing up, and whether it was Next Generation reruns, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, even in the original series from the 60s, you know, whenever it was on, flipping through the channels, we always put it on, and then eventually we started collecting the DVDs when that became a thing, and just went from there.
Star Trek: The Motion Picture, released December 6, 1979. The Federation calls on Admiral James T. Kirk and the crew of the Starship Enterprise to contain an immense Nimbus object that's on a crash course with Earth. After investigating, the crew discovers that the alien cloud harbors artificial intelligence with an ominous primary directive. Crisis strikes when a probe dispatched by the energy cloud attacks the crew, abducting Navigator Lieutenant Ilia. An android lookalike containing her memories shows up soon after.
So let's talk about when we first saw the movie, and then what did we think about it then versus now. And I guess I'll go ahead and start. I saw this movie when I was a kid, and like I mentioned earlier, I was a big fan of the original series. And when I saw the movie, I was kind of disappointed. I kind of felt like there was a disconnect between the characters that I really loved and enjoyed in the show versus these characters I was seeing in the movie. And then I just kind of felt like it was long and slow and boring as a kid. So I have to say it was kind of disappointing. I did see it as an adult. Probably about a year ago, I borrowed Morgan's Blu-ray. I was definitely more surprised about how good it was. I thought it was much better than when I saw it as a kid.
So I think I first saw the movie when I was younger. Probably our dad was watching it. But I just remember finding it very interesting and fascinating, the origins of V'ger. What would I say about it then versus now is Now, I would say the movie definitely is a little bit more slower than I originally remembered. I'd say then I was just more fascinated by V'ger and where it came from, mm-hmm. and how it developed and how it became what it became. And now, maybe it's a little mm-hmm. slower than I remembered.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely catches you off guard because it's this giant AI computer mm-hmm. ball of energy that basically is going around destroying everything in its path. And finding out at the end the origins of how it was developed, it was kind of a nice twist. But it definitely is a slower movie than I remembered.
Right. Yeah, so I was pretty young when I saw it. I don't remember exactly how old, but I remember feeling bored. It moved too slow for me, and I'm almost certain that I watched this particular film the least of the six original cast films. I guess watching it now, older and maybe wiser, definitely has a little more interest than it did. There's still aspects, that I feel move slow for me, but it's definitely kind of focused on different aspects that when you're a kid, you're just kind of looking at the whole, you're just focused on action or effects. And, now it's more about, storyline and dialogue plays a bigger part.
All right. As mentioned before, this movie was released December 7th, 1979. It was directed by Robert Wise, who was an Academy Award winner for Best Director and Best Picture for West Side Story in 1961, and then again with The Sound of Music in 1965. And of course, he had directed a bunch of movies, including The Body Snatcher, Born to Kill, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Run Silent, Run Deep. He had done quite a few different types of movies in the past. So he was definitely a very well-respected and competent director. And something I'll mention about this movie, it was originally going to be a TV show. And the producers were inspired by the success of Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind that they decided, hey, we could really make some cash on this property. So why don't we do a movie instead of a TV show? And so the script that they had written for the pilot episode was expanded and became the script for this movie. Something else about this movie, it was obviously the special effects were a large part of the film, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but the overall cost of this movie was $44 million, which is pretty substantial in 1979, and then the earnings were $139 million. So it made a lot of money back, it was very successful, but the investors were still a little disappointed by the performance. I think they were hoping for Star Wars numbers.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting that originally the film had an initial budget of $8 million, but I guess between all the effects they wanted to do, it quickly ran up the budget. I think Gene Roddenberry himself had to go to the studio to get a bigger budget, basically.
Mm-hmm. Actually, this Star Trek film, the motion pictures, sold the most tickets of any Star Trek movie except for the 2008 Star Trek movie. It was also adjusted for inflation. It's the highest grossing Star Trek movie ever made.
Yeah, so apparently the original screenplay did not have Spock included because there was unpaid royalties and he wasn't intending to come back to reprise his role. But apparently, I read online, his daughter and son-in-law convinced him to meet with someone from the production, and they came to an agreement. He was paid said royalties and signed on to the film.
Something else I'll mention about this film, the director felt like it was super rushed and it was actually never screen tested. So that's a very integral part of the filmmaking process is you get reviews and you kind of get some feedback, you make adjustments in the editing, but they were on such a tight timeline. He personally drove the film to the premiere and it was showed. So it was never screen tested. And he always felt, Robert Wise always felt like the final was more of a rough cut than the final that he really wanted.
Yeah, they said the reels were literally wet when they were being shipped out.
All right, now is the point in the show in which we talk about high fives and low points. And I'll go ahead and get us started. My first high five are the special effects. So even in 2021, when I'm watching this movie, the special effects look pretty good. They stand up pretty well. I will recommend, so I watched this the other night on Pluto TV for free. Morgan, like I mentioned earlier, had loaned me his Blu-ray special edition that where they touched up the special effects, and it was way better. But I do recommend the touched up special effects, but even the ones that are original, even watching it on Pluto, they hold up pretty good. The Enterprise looks fantastic. It looks way better than it ever did in the show, and they know it, and they spend, you know, 20 minutes showing you the Enterprise from stern to bow. The space scenery looks really vast and colorful and gorgeous. The whole scene where Spock is floating into V'ger looks amazing. I think just the effects in general are the major highlight of this film, and they stand up really well even in today.
As you, I think you may have already iterated that several of them hold up pretty good. I guess if I had to pick one, I really liked the first part of the film with the three Klingon battlecruisers going towards the cloud. When they fire the torpedo, there's actually so much detail in the model. There's like a burn around the torpedo launcher. I really thought that was well done.
I would say this movie does kind of reminds me much of a space opera. You know, kind of slow, a lot of visual effects, music.
Mm-hmm. So my next high five is DeForest Kelly playing Dr. McCoy. Always a standout in the show, obviously, in all the movies. He's, you know, he's one of the big three in the original series. I feel like his animated performance was very true to his TV self. He really was dialed into that character, even though it had been, whatever, 10 plus years since he had last played it. He was already dialed in. I felt like it was awesome to see him with a big gnarly beard and a big gold medallion on his, you know, hairy chest. I thought it was just really cool to see a different side of McCoy.
Very 70s.
Yeah, very 70s. But yeah, I felt like he was a big standout in this movie, and I wanted more of him because he was adding a lot of life to this movie, which, you know, we'll get to this in a little bit, but I felt like this movie needed more life, but he was bringing what he could to this film.
Yeah, so I was doing some a little bit of reading or research before we did this podcast. I was reading online that apparently DeForest Kelly had some reservations about the script. He felt the characters and relationships from the series were not really in place. Apparently, him along with Bill Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, they lobbied for greater characterization, but their input was largely ignored.
Actually, that scene that you were talking about where McCoy shows up and he's got his chest hair popping out and the big gold medallion, and he accuses Kirk of basically drafting him back into Starfleet. The way he... It was just a powerful scene, I thought, where Kirk was like, McCoy, I need you.
Yeah.
And, or maybe it was Bones. Bones, I need you.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was pretty disgruntled about being called back. I don't know where he was, but he seemed like he's pretty chill, enjoying his life. Mm-hmm. And he's like, in other words, I've been drafted. And, you know, Kirk's like, but I need you. I need you. And McCoy just kind of stays silent. He shakes his hand and says, fine. You know, basically, in no words, is fine. I'm here.
Yeah. That's good acting. I think it was all on his face. You could see him change from being ticked off about the situation to being like accepting, like, well, this is what I need to do.
And here's the thing, too. Did Kirk really need McCoy? Because he had Nurse Chapel, who is now a doctor. She had moved up and became a doctor. I think it was more that Kirk just wanted the band back together.
Yeah.
Like, he wanted to get the band back together.
Yeah, he didn't need McCoy's medical expertise as much as he needed his confidant. He needed somebody that he could lean on, somebody that was a good balancing act for him.
Yeah.
Because McCoy's way more than just a great doctor.
Yeah. Well, they kind of implied this in the movie that Kirk was looking to get back the Enterprise, even if it was for a moment.
Yeah.
He wanted back the Enterprise. He wanted back McCoy. Mm-hmm. And last, he wanted Spock.
Right.
And that's basically what he got.
Right.
Yeah. So to that point, I always thought that whether you go back to the original series from the 60s, as well as these films, they didn't really have a Counselor Troy from TNG, that character, back then. So I always felt like McCoy was Kirk's advisor or counselor. You know, you remember the scenes from the original series where they go in the either Kirk's quarters or the, I don't know if they'd really have a ready room back then, but, you know, McCoy would pour him a drink and they'd kind of hash over the problem that was going on and go from there.
Yeah, even the new movie series picks up on that. We watched Star Trek Beyond recently, and McCoy is the confidant. You know, he's the one that Kirk leans on.
He's that brutally honest friend that you don't want to hear it. He may tell you that you're wrong or whatever the case may be. Damn it, Jim. But you're going to get a straight answer.
That's right. So my last high five before I turn it over to you guys to hear what your high fives are. The film score. So Jerry Goldsmith scored this film, and the orchestral arrangements are superb. For the first time, you get to hear that theme that I associate with the Next Generation. You get to hear that in all of its glory and splendor. All the orchestral pieces are stellar. And I would say, too, this one's a little bizarre, the V'ger synthesizer sounds that they make. Even though it's abrupt and disturbing, it really fits.
Yeah, I like the score a lot. In fact, it was nominated for Best Music at the Oscars.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the whole synthesizer sound, I think that kind of goes with the time period as well. That's when synthesizers were first becoming more popular. And I think it really kind of adds to the ambiance of the space theme.
Yeah. Yeah, you always knew when they were coming up on V'ger because you would hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just to add to what you guys were saying, you know, Goldsmith obviously was the composer for the score. He also was the composer for the Final Frontier film, First Contact, Insurrection, Nemesis, and then Jeff already mentioned about the Next Generation television series. He was quoted as saying that he was influenced by the style of the romantic sweeping music of Star Wars.
Right.
Regardless of how you may feel about the film, I would say one of my high fives for sure was the return of Kirk, McCoy, and Spock together again.
Definitely.
Like, the trio together and the way they interact, I mean, it's just like in the original series. And, you know, McCoy's a little kind of rough on the edges, maybe a little grumpy at times. I guess he's kind of like the Donald Duck of the Star Trek. And then you have Kirk, you know what I mean, who's this handsome, go-getter, adventurous guy. And then you have Spock, who basically,
he's the brains.
Yeah, he's the brains logic. And logic and thinking things through. He's the scientist. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that trio together really comes through in this movie. I wanted to see more of that. And if anything, this movie, I would say that's their downfall, this movie. Mm-hmm. Is that you don't get to see those three interact as much as you should.
Yeah.
Yeah, I won't go and reiterate too much of what he just said, but yeah, that was definitely a high point or high five for me, was the three of them back together. I felt like they all were very focused and intentional with the portrayal. I didn't feel like they were phoning it in.
You know, going back to what I was saying earlier about as a kid being fascinated with the origins of V'ger and where it came from, I would say that's probably one of my high points about this movie, was the mystery behind it. You don't know who V'ger really is until the very end. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I think it was a nice twist. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that V'ger, spoiler alert, is actually Voyager 6 from Earth.
Yeah.
And it was sent out by humans, and that a advanced AI race found it and upgraded it so it could complete its mission, which is basically to learn all things in the universe.
Yeah.
And so I found that to be very fascinating as a kid, and I think it makes a great story now.
Mm-hmm. If anything, I wondered what happened to V'ger, because after this movie, we never hear about V'ger again. But, you know, now that it's joined with Decker, and it's got Ilea in there somewhere too. I do wonder, where is V'ger? What's it doing? What else is it learning?
And not only that, but who was this AI race?
Yeah.
Like, where are they?
Yeah.
You know, did they just like, you know, give this Voyager 6 a whole bunch of upgrades and then like send it on its way and didn't care what was going to happen after that? Another high five I'd probably give this movie is, this is the first time you get to see the Enterprise refit. And you not only do you get to see the exterior of it, you actually get to see a lot of the interior. And it's vastly different than the Enterprise that you saw in the original series. It seemed a lot larger in the interior than the original series. I remember seeing, you know, the original series back in the day. And you basically get to see the engineering room, Kirk's quarters, a hallway, and the bridge. And in this movie, the interior made it seem a lot larger than what the original series made it seem out to be.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it looked nice.
I thought between the uniforms as well as the interior, it's very clinical. The feel and the colors.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of uniforms, I mean, what did you guys think about the uniforms? I did like the Captain Kirk, the short sleeve and the plunging neckline.
Yeah, kind of a polo-ish shirt, showing off William Shatner's hairy arms.
Yeah.
Not a fan. Probably, I would say almost definitely my least favorite costume of all the series and the films.
Yeah, I know Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura, she was definitely not a fan. She did not feel like they were flattering outfits.
Yeah, she said they were just unisex, which, I mean, obviously they were. There, whether it was a male or female, they're wearing the same uniform. You know, maybe a little, might sound a little sexist, but I miss the short skirts from the 60s myself.
Well, they did have short skirts, but the guys are wearing them too.
Yeah, I feel like the effects, the score, and the trio, Bones, Kirk, and Spock back together, those were definitely the high fives for me. To touch on supporting cast, I thought Stephen Collins' portrayal as Decker was good. He wasn't a Star Trek fan. I don't even know if he'd even watched any of the original series. And he said it was his portrayal was easy. He wasn't nervous or intimidated by the other actors.
Yeah. Now, I felt like Stephen Collins was a highlight of the movie. I felt like a lot of the cast was subdued. They were kind of dialed back. There wasn't a lot of animation or emotion coming from these characters, but Stephen Collins brought it.
I would definitely say this is probably the creepiest of all the Star Treks. Like, the creepiest scene, and I think this probably maybe even scarred me as a kid, is with the teleporting scene where they're we're losing them, we're losing them. It's like, just randomly like screaming. And you're like, oh my gosh, this is not going to turn out well.
I wondered if they were going to show some big lump.
Like a steaming pile with some hair or something.
Something like from the movie The Thing.
The Thing with like a face melted with some teeth sticking out.
I did think it was a little weird how within a few seconds after that scene, it's never really mentioned again. Like, there's no really sadness later.
They never really explain it. So then, like, 5 minutes later is when Bones beams aboard, and there's no worry, no nothing.
Well, they said right before that, they were like, oh, the transporter's fixed. He refuses to come by teleporter, and they bring him anyways or something like that.
Yeah.
But I it's funny when Captain Kirk's is like, did you get him? Did you get the people that are like,
Yeah.
He's like, did they make it on that side? And they're like, they didn't live long, fortunately.
I thought it was weird how they just brought Bones aboard with the transporter. They didn't bring him by shuttle because, you know, after there was a transporter accident episode on Next Generation. And for most of the episode, the transporter was down because it was too great a risk.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like they would go to the secondary protocol for a little while before, do
run
some test runs.
Tests.
Yeah.
They're like, I think we got to fix. Bring up Bones.
Yeah. All right. Now we get into low points. I'll go ahead and get us started. I sorely missed Kirk, Bones, and Spock. Their interaction that I loved and enjoyed from the show. And we see in later movies. We saw it with Star Trek II. We saw it with 3, 4, and 5. Even 6. 5, we talked about that whole row, row, row your boat moment they had.
Gently down the stream.
Yeah. I mean, that was awesome. This movie lacked that for me. So for me, it was a low point. I felt like Spock was cold and distant. But then to also have Kirk acting stern and withdrawn and muscling in what his agenda was. And really you only had Bones kind of being the same old Bones that I knew. I just felt like they weren't gelling like I wanted them to gel.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I do kind of think after I thought about it, it has been say, 5-10 years since they've been together. So, you know, Kurt got a promotion. Mm-hmm. He's in charge of more people. He's kind of a desk jockey now, so to speak. You know, you got Spock that's been trying to go through the Kulinar to purge all emotion. You got McCoy that just wanted to get out of Starfleet. I guess if you look at it from that perspective, I guess it's kind of explained, even though I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the movie, they say it's been 5 years, which they definitely look way more than 5 years older.
Yeah, I think they had to use like lighting tricks to not draw too much focus to that.
Yeah.
My next low point is just the length of the movie. It's 132 minutes long, and it feels like every bit of that. And, you know, I felt like there were a lot of slow, painful scenes, you know, super long. I mean, when they were going into V'ger, it just felt like 10 minutes of close-ups of, like, Sulu's face or Chekhov's face or Kirk's face. And it's like, oh, my gosh, we get it. We get it. They're going into V'ger. And, you know, that whole scene with the wormhole, that took forever. Yeah. That was very, like, trying on my nerves.
I feel like they could have cut that whole part out.
Yeah.
Like, it was pretty unnecessary about the whole wormhole, they hit a wormhole. It does kind of explain later on for the voyage home where they use that to travel back in time.
Right.
It seemed very similar to that, but they didn't know that in this movie. And I just felt like it could have been cut out altogether.
Yeah.
But that being said, it did show the power struggle between Kirk and Deckard.
Yeah. And I think it gave Decker, you know, it showed that he was competent and he knew the ship better than Kirk did.
Yeah. It kind of showcased this power struggle that Kirk and Deckard were having. But at the same point, Deckard throws that all away at the end.
Yeah.
He takes off with Ilia. If the Enterprise was really that big of a deal, which, by the way, he knew Ilia before.
Yeah.
He knew Ilia before. He had a priority, which was to take command of the Enterprise and be the captain of the Enterprise. That was his priority. And then out of nowhere, at the very end, he basically throws that all away to be with a probe. It wasn't even with Ilia, the original Ilia. It was a probe created by V'ger.
Yeah.
And he gives away the Enterprise.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm guessing that's your first low point, but I agree with you wholeheartedly. It really didn't make sense. Why did Decker leave Ilia to begin with? So he could have been with her, but chose to leave. And they don't really go into why he had to leave and all that. But then he throws away all of his life, literally his life, to be with her. But it's not really her. It's really like she's the...
Why didn't he do that before?
Yeah.
Like, when you had the real one,
why
didn't you take her before?
Yeah.
Instead, you wait till now. And it just sounds like convenient writing by the writers.
Yeah.
Like, they needed to get him out of the way somehow. And they were like, hey, let's just make him go with Ilia.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's, like, giving him puppy dog eyes, too, I noticed, too. Like, when he's looking, she's looking at him longingly.
Yeah.
And they try to explain it that, like, there's a little bit of Ilia in there still.
Even though she's a probe, she still has kind of the memory imprints and the emotion imprint.
Yeah.
But her species, like, excretes pheromones or something. That's the whole point when she first comes on the bridge. Like, the first thing out of her mouth is, I've sworn an oath to celibacy because apparently it... You know, the other other species, males, can't control themselves around her.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think even Sulu had his tongue out.
Sulu, yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah, she came on the bridge. She's like, oh, my. I mean, I guess I would agree with you. One of the low points I would have is just the length and slowness of the film. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate a slow, visually impaling movie. A visually...
Not impaling.
a visually appealing movie. But in this case, it just seemed like there was a whole lot of fluff, and then they could have cut down a lot on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so another low point that we haven't touched on, I thought, was other supporting cast, Walter Koenig as Chekhov, George Takei as Sulu, Nichelle Nichols as Uhura. They had very little to do, I believe... they all said that that was a chief complaint of theirs. They just really had nothing to do. It's kind of disappointing. I mean, I know in the original series, there was episodes the same way. They didn't have much going on. But I thought for the being a feature film, they should have made more of an effort to give them more of an integral part of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, they gave a lot of airtime, obviously, to Decker and to Ilea, but it was at the expense of these others, you know, Scotty, Sulu, Uhura.
SDK, I'm sure, would complain. A lot of rewrites favored Bill Shatner. That's what he used to always say.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
No, yeah, I can agree with all that. I would say that if they cut back on some of the scenes that were just of visually appealing scenes or the scene with the wormhole, that they could allocate more time to those supporting casts that we wanted to see. We wanted to see Uhura more. Mm-hmm. We wanted to see Sulu more. But we didn't really get it. They had a very little part in this movie, and I would say that's also one of my down points.
All right, so we've talked quite a bit about the different cast members. I don't think we've talked a whole lot about Shatner. None of us said he was a high point, but he definitely wasn't a low point either. I felt like he did a fine job. You know, he obviously was playing the role of, you know, a man that's trying to get back control of his ship. And even if he has to kind of be cold and a little bit nasty to Decker, who originally he had recommended for the position, it kind of showed the cold-bloodedness of Kirk, that he was able to flip the switch and get what he really wanted, which was ultimately the Enterprise.
Yeah, I mean, Kirk even told Decker when he recommended him for the Enterprise that he would find a way to get back command of the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And Decker knew that, and he remembered, and he mentions that in the movie.
Yeah.
Basically calling out Kirk.
Yeah.
But
yeah, a little fun fact about Decker is Gene Roddenberry wrote a novelization of the motion picture, the only film that he wrote a novelization for. And there's more backstory on several of the characters, specifically Decker. His father was Commodore Decker, if you recall from the original series episode, The Doomsday Machine. Mm. He got killed. He was on the USS Constellation.
Okay. Yeah, I hadn't put that together. And then Spock, we talked about him being cold and distant, but how did you feel like Nimoy did reprising the role?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this kind of set the tone for future Spock. In the original series, although Leonard Nimoy Spock was very logical and cold at times, he seemed to be a little bit more human. But he is, you know, after all, half human. And so I think in the original series, they definitely played upon that more. Mm-hmm. But in this movie, he was through and through Vulcan. He was pure Vulcan. And I believe the Vulcan female in the beginning at the Kulinar even mentions his half-human blood and how he forsakes that.
Well, you know, though, but I think there was a little bit of disdain there. But I think originally you're right. But then when he was, like, he kind of rejected whatever metal or something.
Yeah, V'ger was somehow telepathically contacting him, or he felt its presence, and she mind-melded with him. And when she realized that he wasn't apparently thinking logically.
Yeah. And she indicated, like, his human side was taken over.
His human side was talking, not his Vulcan side. And basically rejected him for the Kulinar.
Giving him crap about being human.
Yeah, I'd like to read this quote, which I think would really falls in line with what we've been talking about how William Shatner seems a lot different as Kirk and the other actors the same way. So at a March 1978 press conference, he was asked what it would be like to reprise the role. His response was, "An actor brings to a role not only the concept of a character, but his own basic personality, things that he is, and both Leonard Nimoy and myself have changed over the years to a degree at any rate, and we will bring that degree of change inadvertently to the role we recreate."
And you can see it. They just seem different. I always felt like the movie series, their characterization, and they take it much further than they do in this movie. But when I watch the original series, it still feels different. You know, like we talk about that scene, the row, row, row your boat scene. You wouldn't have gotten that in the original series. As much as we love it in the movies, it's kind of like they've progressed, they've moved on, and they've changed. It's not what we saw in the original series. And
yeah, those like old friends around a campfire. I mean, you can't do that when you're still young and you haven't known each other that many years.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So now, as far as rating this movie, you know, we really just do yay or nay. Would you recommend this movie for other people?
Yeah, I think it's got some good elements. unfortunately, or it is my least favorite of the six original cast films. Mm-hmm. I would not recommend it to somebody that is brand new to Star Trek, has never watched a series or any of the films. I mean, once you've watched some or all of the original series, I mean, obviously it's the natural progression, but that's where things stand on it for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with Morgan on this one. I wouldn't say it's my least favorite. I would probably put it at maybe number four for mm-hmm. me, but I wouldn't recommend someone who's never seen Star Trek before to start off on this one.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a fan of Star Trek, maybe you've seen the original series or you've seen the next gen mm-hmm. and you want to see some more Star Trek, yeah, I definitely recommend seeing this movie.
Yeah.
Just keep an open mind. It was made in 1979, though. You know, some of the scenes are a little slow. They kind of had like a space opera mindset at that time mm-hmm. when it came to movies. You had the 2001 Space Odyssey. Mm-hmm. It's kind of very similar. Kind of a lot of visual effects, a lot of thought-provoking images.
Yeah.
And not really a lot of action.
Yeah, I feel like it's cerebral in nature. It's not the action and adventure that you get of Star Wars. And it's not the action adventure that you get in Star Trek 2. You know, obviously the new Star Trek movie series focuses on more action and adventure. So you're not going to get that. I think if you're a huge Star Trek fan, you've probably already seen it. I know it's divisive with Star Trek fans. I think overall, I feel like it could have been a lot shorter. And it probably would have been better as a TV show. Like if they had gone with the original plan to do a TV show, I could have seen this as a two-parter. You know, like 2 30-minute episodes or 2 45-minute episodes. I think it would have been stronger.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, with this being at the front, I feel like they kind of started on a low point, but I guess on the bright side, you can only go up from here.
Yeah. We do have a couple fan comments about this movie. Again, you can comment on Attack of the 20th Century on Facebook and Instagram. You know, go ahead and throw out your comments and we'll read them on the air. Ranger Cosplay, an old friend of ours, says, kind of tedious, but seeing the cast back together after so long and on the big screen makes up for it. I think part two was a big improvement, and I think we're with you there, Ranger Cosplay.
Yeah, by the end of the film, I mean, it really did feel like the camaraderie was back. It didn't, unfortunately, it was almost the tail end of the film, but at that point, Spock, Bones, and Kirk, you know, it really captured that nostalgia of the 60s series.
Fresno Film Buff said, I would argue it's one of the most beautiful sci-fi movies ever made. Glad people are starting to come around to it.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I would say the visual effects in this movie are very impressive compared to other movies at the time. And then, you know, other Star Trek movies. Mm-hmm. They're not very visually inclined as much as this movie. And this kind of emphasizes the visual effects more so.
Yeah, it's definitely a gorgeous film to see. All right, so while I have these Trekkie experts, I want to go ahead and ask, what is your favorite Star Trek villain of all time? And this could be across any of the series, any of the movies. Who is your favorite villain?
So for a single villain, I got to go with Khan Noonien Sung, expertly portrayed by Ricardo Montalban in the second original cast film, Wrath of Khan. I mean, just the back and forth with him and Kirk, the established relationship from the 60s episode Space Seed. I mean, you really can't go wrong, and I'd really challenge anybody to put up somebody above him. As far as a species or race, I got to kind of do a two-parter. I got to go with the Borg. Love the Borg episodes, whether it's Next Gen, Deep Space Nine, Voyager. Actually, I don't know if Deep Space Nine actually had any Borg episodes, but I know the other series just did. Definitely a big fan of that.
Say my favorite adversarial species in Star Trek is the Dominion. You hear about them about an end of season one in Deep Space Nine, and you're like, who's the Dominion? The guy who created these holograms even said that they had a whole thriving civilization before the Dominion came. Mm-hmm. And all the cast look at each other like, who are these Dominion people? And you hear about them here and there in seasons 2 and 3, but I don't think you actually see the Dominion in Deep Space Nine until episode 4.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're ruthless. Their main army foot soldiers are the Jem'Hadar, who were basically born and bred to be soldiers. And they're led by the changelings, who mm-hmm. can take form of basically anything. So they could turn into a human, and they use that to their advantage to infiltrate Starfleet on multiple occasions. They could be a bird. They could fly in and just listen into a conversation. And that's why they're my favorite.
Yeah. For me, you know, I never watched Deep Space Nine, but the next gen, the introduction of the Borg, we saw that in the theater where Q introduces the Enterprise to the Borg. Yeah, I mean, they're awesome. Just their ability to adapt and change and learn. And just their aesthetic, too, I think it's really cool. It's very different than what we saw anything in the original series. But I'm with you. I think Ricardo Montalban, as far as like a single adversary, you know, he's got those pretty impressive pecs, which I saw in an interview. He's always asked, like, are those really your pecs? Or are those fakes? Like, no, those are really mine. You know, he didn't skip chest day.
And it was a good time error, too, in the 70s. They were definitely into showing their chest.
Yeah.
So it kind of worked out well for him.
I agree. All right. What are we doing next week?
Okay. The next movie on the list is a classic Hitchcock. We're going to be watching Vertigo.
Ooh.
Yeah. Vertigo is rated PG, but Common Sense Media does recommend it for 13 and up. Just because it can be a little intense. There's a lot of kind of fear and manipulation happening there. But as far as like modern movies go, you're not seeing anything that you don't want your kids to see. But it could be intense, so you just need to know that going
in. It's creepy, intense, but definitely safe, I would say.
Yeah. Did I say it's only rated PG?
Yeah, you did.
Okay. Couldn't remember if I said that or not.
What's it rated?
I think it's rated PG.
Where can we watch it?
Okay, so this one is probably available in the local library, though I haven't checked, but I do know it's rentable on the Fandango app or Vudu, that's V-U-D-U, and also on Apple TV, it's rentable there.
And didn't you say it was on YouTube?
Oh, and it is rentable from YouTube, yes, I did say that earlier.
Cool.
I forgot.
All right, that does it for us. I really appreciate Marcus and Morgan joining us.
Hey, glad to be here, I really appreciate it. And as always, live long and prosper.
Hey, thanks for the invite. First podcast, definitely a different experience, but it was a good time, and hopefully we'll be back for another one down the road.
Be sure to listen to Attack of the 20th Century. Resistance is futile.
Peace out.
Peace out.